ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to A Big Country. I'm Clint Jasper. Thanks for joining me. This week, we're visiting a bushfire-affected community where residents are rebuilding homes and lives with the help of an initiative that epitomises community spirit. They've started a cooperative tool library that's lending out building and landscaping equipment and helping to get lives back on track. And we'll chat with a second-generation truffle farmer. Despite being run off her feet working with her truffle-hunting dogs to unearth fresh fungi for a winter food festival in Tassie, she is thoroughly loving her line of work.
For me, I just love doing this. I've been pulling truffles out of the ground for as long as I can remember alongside Dad. I've been eating them since I was three, and there's something that tickles my heartstrings every time I go out there with the dogs. And I don't know whether it's the excitement of not knowing what I'm going to dig up or whether it's just getting to hang out with my best mates every day, but it's a pretty special thing and I'm very lucky to be able to do it. I won't be stopping anytime soon.
We'll meet that truffle grower and her canine workmates a little later in the program. First today, with koala populations crashing faster than ever before, especially in urban areas, Indigenous educators on the New South Wales mid-north coast believe a whole community response is needed, and they're starting with preschoolers. They've developed a program to teach children to care for koalas and country. Reporter Wiri Asati spoke to the creators of the project, Ali Meehan and Auntie Rhonda, to find out more.
We're trying to build the next generations as eco-warriors. I'm Ali Gillingmeehan and I'm a Biripi woman. Been working with the Gulagimbai program with preschools on Biripi Barai, Biripi country. I'm a PhD candidate with the University of Newcastle. And I'm really looking at the eco-acoustics of country, specifically focusing on gula, or the koala, and how our sonic realities as human make us relate to more than human kin with, on and as country. We're looking at the sustainability, the next generations come up. They feel that sense of family and responsibility for country, and they're going to listen. And hopefully those messages land within them and they know what to do, how to put those messages into action for caring for gula, caring for Biripi Barai, Biripi country.
My name's Rhonda Radley, known in the community as Auntie Rhonda, and I've just finished my PhD thesis, research on teaching language with gesture. Today has been totally awesome. So Gulagimbai program grew from, I think, my passion to go out into the community and talk caring for gula and country up. And if you really want to teach the community, I believe, is that you start with the little ones. So we had this opportunity to run the program through the preschools, and that was totally awesome. One, that I had did some research at a preschool in regards to children learning Gatang language with gesture. So it was an opportunity also to bring that into the program. Well, we can't teach looking after country in a classroom. We have to actually be on country. So the children have that sensory experience with country. And it's the way that we teach language.
So that whitey will grow strong.
So the sounds come from country, and I believe that the children really connect to it in a deeper way.
So this program really focuses on Ngarralin, deep listening to country, and allows younger people to have that experience of relating to the sounds.
We have been practicing whole body listening, we say Ngarralin, and we've also been practicing whole body talking through our dancing and singing.
My name's Maria Doherty and I'm the General Manager for Koala Conservation Australia. We really have to engage a lot with our community, and education's a key part of that. So we're trying to get people to understand how important koalas are in our landscape. Also the status of koala populations at the moment and how their populations are rapidly crashing. So it's just amazing that, you know, we're embedding this in and planting that seed, so to speak, in little kids, but also the physical planting of seeds as well is awesome.
Well, my name's Brendan, his name's River, and we go to the early years nature school. Uh-oh. It's good to be able to learn to respect the plants and the animals and the land and the country, and actually learn about it and not just walk on it.
So my name's Ashley Goodwill and I work for North Coast Local Land Services on a koala restoration and protection project in areas between Port Macquarie and Coffs Harbour on Goombangia, Dungari and Biripi country. We know that children are the next generation and the next generation of custodians in koala country, and we're really thrilled that they can be learning both in culture about the importance of koala or gula to this area, the Port Macquarie area. And yeah, we're really thrilled to have been able to work and support it as well.
The Indigenous approach to caring for country is just beautiful. I mean, it's been harnessed and finessed over hundreds and hundreds of years. To engage with young people from such an early age and to embed that understanding is really, really key, and really key to changing the culture as well, I think. So it's fabulous. I've just loved the whole idea of it, and yeah, to get them involved in it at such an early age is the way to go for the future. You know, you've got wildlife warriors pretty much for the rest of their lives.
Got some of our truffles here, but there's plenty more where they came from that have already made their way down to Winter Feast earlier this morning, so ready to go on some fresh truffle pizzas for the next 2 weeks.
At her truffle farm at Deloraine in northern Tasmania, Anna Terry has been busy doing her bit to contribute to the state's big winter cultural festival, Dark Mofo. With the help of her canine friends, who help sniff out fresh truffles, Anna has been preparing produce to be part of the festival's Winter Feast event.
So to get them out of the ground, we need these guys right here at your feet, my beloved pooches. So they help us find where the truffles are. They detect when they're nice and mature and ready to come out of the ground. We're very fortunate here that we have both summer and winter truffles, and we're one of the only farms in the country that have both. And that was purely back 20 years ago. My father basically established the truffle industry here in Australia and grew and unearthed the first truffle in the country here on our property back in 1999. So I guess there's a fair bit of science that goes into actually growing these guys and inoculating the trees so that they start to produce the fungi, and then a lot of work to look after and tend to the trees to make sure they keep producing. So we're currently in our overlap between our summer and our winter season is just starting, so we've sort of got two plantations to get across at the moment, so it's busy times, but plenty of these guys.
Hello, I'm Meg Powell and I'm sitting with Anna and her very important helpers, these truffle detection dogs. She says over the years, she's discovered that some dogs are better suited to truffle work than others.
So back when we first started, we used to think it was very much breed dependent. But for me, over the years, personally, I've found that personality trumps breed any day of the week. I've had very elite, probably, breeds of dogs that are seen to have great noses on them and be, I guess, built for this sort of skill. But on the flip side of that, I've had dogs that I've got from the pound that have been tenfold better just because they've wanted a purpose, wanted a passion and wanted a person to love. And that's a really special thing to be able to give them. So these guys, as well as work dogs, they are pets, and that's really, really important for this job because they feed off, I guess, my enthusiasm, and they want to work for me, not just for a reward.
Who have we got here today?
You've got Peggy below you being very cutchy. Then we've also got Douglas, who is our golden lab, and then Poppy as well, who is our labradoodle. Poppy didn't start her training till a bit later in life, till she was about 2 years of age. She was actually a friend's pet, and then she has become signature truffle dog. So very much personality-based for me, and looking for those little characteristics that show that they really want to please and have fun with their mum while hanging out here in the dirt.
Well, there you go. Never too late for a career change, yeah. Even for a dog.
Exactly right.
Now, tell me a little bit about the market for truffles, because you would have seen quite a change over your years of doing it. They started as a very rare, very expensive food. They're still kind of
kind of bougie, to be honest. But how has it changed?
So I guess back when we first started 20 years ago, my folks didn't even really have any domestic market for these guys. Everything we had to go overseas because there was so little awareness about truffles here in Australia. So one of the great things about having an industry now across the country with great farms in WA, South Australia, Canberra, is that we have a lot more awareness about the fungi, but also the market is a lot more flooded too. So the price point has significantly dropped if you compare that to sort of that of 15, 20 years ago, absolutely. But it's also great that we're able to move our product here in our own country. That makes it a lot easier for us, particularly you can imagine the challenges of passing customs and quarantine when they're covered in dirt, the cleaning process, all of those factors. And the shelf life is pretty limited on these guys as well, of about 2 weeks. So trying to get it across the other side of the globe, really challenging. So although the price point has dropped, there is the massive benefit that we're able to move it here. And even, I guess, for us over the last 5 years, we keep a lot more of our truffle even here in Tasmania and rely less on mainland Australia, which is exciting that the foodie culture in Tassie has grown and we've got a lot of chefs and things here that we've been liaising and dealing with for 10 or 15 years, and that they can sort of call me up and say, hey Anna, how's it looking out there? Like, I'm covered in dirt, guys, I'm wet, I'll call you back in a minute and let you know what I found for you. So it's really special to have those relationships ongoing.
What kind of volume are you producing nowadays? I guess especially in the early days, it wasn't a lot.
We don't disclose our total yields, and that is because we've got two different varieties of truffle as well. So to sort of keep track of exactly what tree produces what, it's a little bit out of control to be able to do that. But in theory, I guess, you know, if we do right by the tree, we're also dependent a lot on Mother Nature as to how the season's going to go. These guys are quite particular in their growth conditions and things like that. So we make sure that we can do everything we can management-wise to give them every chance to get nice and big in size and to grow a good population of them, but a lot of it is left up to the weather gods as well.
What kind of maintenance do they need and inputs along the way? I mean, other crops need a lot of fertiliser, they need spraying. Do you just leave them to grow or do they need a bit of care?
Truffles do need a bit of care, but in saying that as well, it's a fine line. We don't want to be putting fertilisers and things in the soil that are going to potentially damage the aroma, the safety for consumption or the palate of these guys either. So we keep fertiliser free here, but there is a lot of maintenance in terms of keeping that pH up of the soil, doing a lot of soil tests, pruning of the trees, irrigation, those factors. And when I guess you're looking at each tree individually as well, it is a fair bit of work to make sure that they are going to keep producing.
What kind of trees are they?
So these ones here behind me are an English oak or a Quercus roba, and we also have the Quercus ilex, which is like a holly oak as well, and that is what we grow our winter truffles under, those ones. For me, I just love doing this. I've been pulling truffles out of the ground for as long as I can remember alongside Dad. I've been eating them since I was three, and there's something that tickles my heartstrings every time I go out there with the dogs. And I don't know whether it's the excitement of not knowing what I'm going to dig up or whether it's just getting to hang out with my best mates every day, but it's a pretty special thing and I'm very lucky to be able to do it. I won't be stopping anytime soon.
Anna Terry from Tasmanian Truffles. She was speaking with our reporter Meg Powell. I'm Clint Jasper with you on RN. Still to come, we're visiting Cobargo in southeast New South Wales, where a tool library is helping local residents to rebuild their homes after the 2019-2020 Black Summer bushfires. Reporter Floss Adams caught up with project manager Monica Considine at the Triangle Toolshed.
This trailer is available to the community to borrow. And some of the tools in it as well. Also cement mixers and things like that are part of what, you know, do you really need to buy one? How often are you going to use it? There's a real benefit here to reducing the amount of waste in our community.
Like many Cobargo locals, Monica Considine dreamt about creating a tool library in her community, but it never came to fruition. But that changed when the Black Summer bushfires tore through her community on the far south coast of New South Wales in late 2019 and early 2020. A major rebuild effort was needed to get the community back on its feet. Millions of dollars of donations poured into bushfire-affected communities, giving life to the idea for what is now called the Triangle Tool Library, a project which was always front of mind for Miss Considine.
So welcome to the Triangle Tool Library in Cobargo. We've been around since July 2020. So we started after the bushfires. There were various people who were wanting to start a tool library anyway, myself included. And in one way, the silver lining of the bushfires was that the momentum was there. to start this one, people had lost their sheds, they hadn't rebought tools, they had lost a lot of tools that they weren't going to be able to replace. And so when we started, we were helping people get back on land, get back to their properties and begin the process of rebuilding. So there was definitely about, the first year was all about recovery. But then we got $134,000 from the BCRRF, which is the Bushfire Community Recovery and Resilience Fund. And that allowed us to buy a whole lot of tools that helped us with recovery, but also started us on the track of resilience. And so we bought tools in the building and horticultural area. So food and shelter, I guess, is a way of thinking about it. Helping people with things like laser level, which is one of our most popular items, or scaffolding. You know, most people don't have scaffolding, but it allows you to work faster and safer. And then on the horticultural side, we have a walk-behind tractor, designed so that if people are developing a new garden or re-establishing an old garden, it takes the grunt work out of it, doing it by hand with a fork or a broad fork. They can actually get in there and do it all in a couple of hours. So really just those bigger tools that people wouldn't necessarily buy for themselves, couldn't quite justify buying one just for them, their own place, and that they can borrow it from here and take a big, huge step forward on a project.
If I owned a house, I'd be here every weekend. This is so cool.
It's good. We have three containers and one shed. So this shed, which the Cabago Co-op call the oil shed, we use for carpentry projects. And so we have various, we'll go in, we have various people who, I guess, not quite sure if they're, let's say they're doing a window or a door. What we have here is a few volunteers who will help them. So it's more like a men's shed where you have volunteers who help you maybe think through a project. We have a whole lot of gear, carpentry gear available. And a lot of this came through men's sheds donations. But we also have things like a young bloke here gave us a thicknesser. It's his. He doesn't want it to be loaned out, but he is happy for people to use it under supervision so they don't mess it up. So we're a lot about respecting the tool and sharing the knowledge about how to use it. And the networks of people that kind of happen around those conversations. So somebody who's new to the area might come in here with a project and meet a few of the volunteers and then meet somebody else who's doing a similar project. And next thing you know, they've got in touch. And they've met somebody in the area.
Do you find though that the people that were accessing the tool library in the beginning, have they kind of gone, oh, I've built everything I need now, I'm okay, and you're seeing new people come
well,
in, or?
There's a little bit of that. Certainly as people rebought the tools and set up their sheds again and got the stuff they needed, for instance, a drill and a driver. If you're out in a rural property, you don't want to be driving into town to a tool library 45 minutes just to get a drill and a driver and then have to bring it back. So yeah, they've rebought their basic day-to-day tools, but I think they are valuing the service for the once-off tools. And there's also a bit of try before you buy. There's different demographics who are interested in becoming a member of the tool library. The locals in the village of Cabago might be renters who don't have a full set of tools and, you know, they just want basic stuff like a drill and a driver. But where in our, now that we're sort of 3 years in, where we seem to be fulfilling a role, a niche kind of role in the community, is the stuff that you use once in the blue moon, like let's say a $1,500 laser level or a $3,000 brick saw or concrete saw, or maybe a bigger chainsaw than you normally use, or a bigger, you need a second brush cutter because a friend is coming down, a gyprock lifter, scaffolding. So those things that you might not have at home and can't quite justify using, buying one just for yourself, once in the blue moon, that seems to be where people are valuing what we do and becoming a member. It's $50 a year to be a member. Most things are free after that, but we do clip the ticket on items such as chainsaws and brush cutters that tend to have a big wear and tear factor, so that we can put that money into a sinking fund to buy a new one at some point.
At her property in Paringa, perched on the limestone cliffs above the Murray River in South Australia's Riverland, Jan Cousins is collecting macadamias off the ground.
So these one I'd leave, even though they're quite big. And sometimes
the 55 macadamia trees in her orchards are not enough to justify employing pickers. So she does it herself using a rolling nut harvester.
It's got like wire fingers and it's absolutely brilliant. I used to pick the nuts up bending over, and now I've got this roller, which it's hard to describe, long stick, and I just go around and pick them up like that.
She walks from tree to tree, holding a steel pole attached to a round wire basket that rolls over the nuts to pick them up.
The wire's quite soft. When I push it onto the nuts, it just picks them up and fills up into the roller, and then I just pull the wires apart and they fall out. It saves the back, and it's a really quick way of picking them up off the ground.
Hello, I'm Eliza Burlage, and I'm walking through this orchard with Jan Cousins. These trees came with the property when Jan purchased it, and she had to do some research into how to grow and harvest the popular nuts.
I didn't really know much about them, so I had to do a bit of Googling. They tend to grow all year round. Obviously, they blossom in spring, and then they seem to be on the tree all the time. And I just pick them up when they fall on the ground. And then when I pick the nuts up, I have to take the green outer shell off because they'll go mouldy. And then they have to be dried out for about 6 weeks so you can actually get the nut out of the shell. And the macadamia nut is the hardest nut to crack, and everyone seems to love them.
How do you dry them out?
I just put them in the onion bags and just hang them in the shed, because I find it's really hard to get the nut out of the shell if they're not dry, and they can kind of be a bit rubbery. About 6 weeks hanging in onion bags in the shed, and then they're ready to eat. So you can oven dry them. I just sell them in the shell because it's very time consuming to crack the nuts.
How much water do they need?
With all nuts, they need lots of water. So that's my issue here, is it costs more to water the trees than what I actually get off them. So it's kind of a hobby, really. It's not really my main income or anything like that. Some of the trees produce more nuts than others, obviously depending on the water. I have some trees that don't have any nuts on them, and that's lack of water.
How many nuts would you say you get off your trees each year, sort of on average?
You can see these trees here, they are quite loaded if we go in closer. Could be up to 500 nuts on a tree. The trees are 28 years old. I just worked that out from, I knew the previous owners when they planted them and that. And they have to be pruned. They don't drop a lot of leaves, which is great. And they've got that green look all year round, which is great. But they're very prickly, the leaves. So these are, you know, obviously I like to leave them on as long as possible so that they can grow a bit bigger. Some of them fall off on the ground, as you can see here. Some of them can be quite small. This one here, it's kind of easier to get the shell off because it's dried. Sometimes if you rattle it, you know that you're going to be able to crack that one and it'll come out, but that one needs to dry out a bit more. We'll go up to this next tree here.
Yeah, they're very hard, the green ones. They're how long until they're probably ready to drop?
I've got the some of the brown shell ones, which is the outer shell. You've got the green shell, which are not as dry as the brown shell. And I've actually knocked them off today, some of them, with this. So you can see here, I'll just leave them for a bit. See, these ones here, the nuts will just fall out. It's kind of funny how it varies. There's a lot of the brown, which are a lot drier, that are still sitting on the tree. You know, if I have a bit of a storm or something, they'll fall down. But yeah, so we've got the green bunches here, and we've got the brown ones there.
With only small quantities of nuts, Jan sells her macadamias as a little side hustle, mostly through social media.
I kind of sell them just because they're there. Sometimes I hoard up quite a few kilos just waiting for them to dry and forget about, you know, selling them. But because I've noticed there's a lot around on the trees and that, I've just put them up now and then. But I don't sell a lot. I have a lot of people inquiring.
What's your favourite way to enjoy macadamias?
Well, the hardest thing is when you crack them, try to gather up a few and put in a container, but you tend to eat more than pack them away. I was going to sell them cracked, but that hasn't happened because it's too much eating going on. I was told about salting them and putting them and heating them is a good thing. I haven't actually done that yet, but a friend of mine said they're to die for if you salt them and heat them in the oven. So that's yet to be tested or tried.
It's like a good winter warmer.
It's amazing how popular they are too. You know, everyone, you know, pretty much seems to love them. They're quite tasty to some people, that's for sure.
Jan Cousins, the only macadamia grower in South Australia's Riverland. She was speaking with our reporter, Eliza Burlidge. That's the show for today. Thanks for listening and bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.